Your countdown clock has now terminated function. Your time is up. Your time is up. Your time is up.
Right now, having a national security scare is actually good political news for the president and the White House and the Republican Party.
Morning, you will be monitored by CCTV.
But the problem today is that the situation is so large and so all-encompassing that whatever is going to happen, the whole world is going to feel it. Everything. Everyone's going to feel this one.
The answer to 1984 is 1776.
Illuminating Radio. Alex Ansari. Outside the Box.
It is the 10th day of September in the year 2008. We'll be with you for the next 2 hours right here on We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com. A lot of stuff to talk about tonight. We'll be taking your phone calls at 512-646-1984. A lot of stuff on the table. We have CERN kicking off today. We have the escalation of war in Georgia. We see a lot of weaponry being moved towards the direction of the Black Sea. And a lot of other things in the news. With us tonight, we'll talk to him in just a little bit. He's here at the bookstore where we're broadcasting at Laughing Horse Books in Portland, Oregon. Michael Mayow, he's running for the 3rd U.S. Congressional District. He's the Pacific Green nomination, and he's a teacher of mathematics at Benson Polytech High School, and we'll get to him in just a little bit. But I want to start with going over some of the latest economic headlines. The first one we'll go over, and then we'll get to some of the other news. Taxpayers take on trillions in risk in Fannie Freddie takeover. The unprecedented federal takeover of mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae announced on Sunday is described as a bold attempt to stabilize financial markets and restore the faltering housing market. In reality, it thrusts trillions of dollars of risk directly onto taxpayers' shoulders. The government is no longer regulating the market. They have now become the market. So it's raising a lot of questions as to what kind of system is this? Is this actually a free market system, or is this some sort of de facto system of communism or socialism they're pushing in the back door? All right, now get ready for this. 11th bank failure in U.S. this year. Silver State Bank of Henderson, with $2 billion in assets and $1.7 billion in deposits, was shut down by the Nevada Financial Institutions Division and the FDIC, same FDIC that's going broke right now, leaning on the Treasury. This is amid a surge in soured real estate loans stemming from the worst housing slump since the Great Depression. Banks are being closed at the fastest pace in 14 years, and regulators have publicly ordered dozens of institutions to shore up capital or restrict their business. All right, now this next headline is nothing new here. Brazil, Argentina to eliminate the U.S. dollar. The move is viewed as an important step towards a common currency among the members of, if I enunciate this incorrectly, Mercosur. That's the South American Union, the SAU, South American Trading Bloc, and that was founded several months ago. That comprises of Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and soon Venezuela. Same Venezuela that's working with the Russians right now militarily. Argentina has become Brazil's third largest trading partner after the United States and China. In our next headline, OPEC cuts output to keep oil above $100 per barrel. That's coming to us from the London Guardian. The oil price rebounded this morning after OPEC announced a surprise cut in production in an attempt to halt the recent decline in the cost of a barrel of crude. Having fallen by about 30% in the last 2 months to the fringes of the symbolic $100 mark, U.S. crude jumped by over a dollar to $103.30 this morning. All right, we're going to take this time now and switch gears here and talk with a local gentleman who's going to be running against Earl Blumenhauer here in Oregon. How are you doing today, sir? And what's your first and last name?
I'm Michael Mayow. I'm the nominee of the Pacific Green Party. There are three candidates in the race. One, the Democrat, Earl Blumenhauer, is a 10-time incumbent and has been in office since 1996. The other is the Republican, Delia Lopez, and her major campaign issue is she hates immigrants for some reason or another.
Well, what are some of the things that you are intending to change? Why you're planning to run against Earl Blumenauer? Some of the issues that you want to bring up?
The United States for the last 30 years has become increasingly the military-industrial state that President Eisenhower, limited though he was as a man of peace, warned us about when he resigned office, when he left office. And he said that we should beware the growth of a military-industrial complex. We have become in the last 30 years a national security state, become a rogue nation whose empire has nothing to stop that war. As a result of that, I could not just vote for the Green Party. I had to do something more, and that something more turned out to be I volunteered to run against Blumenauer, the representative in my locality of that do-nothing Democratic Party.
You know, I was looking at Willamette Week today, and I was reading about the corruption behind Gordon Smith. And while he had said that he was against illegal immigration, at the same time he was caught, you know, trying to play the other side by hiring a bunch of illegals at his factory way out there on the east side of Oregon over by Walla Walla. Did you get all of that story at all or hear that?
I am not up to date on exactly all of the local offenses of the Republican party of lies and misrepresentations. But I can tell you that both major political parties rest upon a cynical estimation of what they're doing with the votes of people who put them into office. The cynical misrepresentation is that they are going to represent your interests. In no way do the major political parties feel that way. They have a public face, and they do what they can do to get elected. When they have done that, then they have taken power, and they use that for their real employers, the corporate interests of the United States.
Now, for those listening, I've never talked to Michael before this show. We just kind of met each other literally about 15 minutes ago. How do you view what we're seeing in the political theater today with Obama and McCain? Do you see a difference between either of these gentlemen?
We do have a difference in the question of their superficial appeal. When we have Mr. McCain, he wants war, and he's very explicit about it. It's bomb, 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 Iran, ha, ha, ha. So that is what he's telling you. He is a man who has apparently been traumatized by the amount of time he spent in a prison. I myself was in prison, but I was imprisoned during the same time he was in prison. I was imprisoned by the United States of America. But I was traumatized by that. I'll give a short account of that, perhaps, if you want to know. But the fact is, Obama, his opponent, is simply saying he can better run the empire, and it is one without a brutal face to the war. The war in which he will have is one which will concentrate on Afghanistan and run down or withdraw slowly from Iraq. Both of them are doing the same thing. We have this large empire. This empire has to be handled and handled for the corporate interests of the United States. That's what they're mainly engaged in pursuing.
Obama and McCain, one and the same. All right, we have a question from someone in the audience. If you want to come up here next to the mic. And how you doing, Richard?
Fine. Nice to see you. My question to you is, and I've thought about this American industrial complex with over 800 foreign military bases. That's official. I'm sure the classified ones are well over 1,000 all over the place. And just spending billions and billions a day.
We're back. We're going to cover some news in this hour and the next hour, but we have two phone calls if we can get them on. We have Brian in Pennsylvania and another call after that. We'll go to Brian, and then we will go back to Michael. Brian, are you with us? I can hear you. You're on the air now.
All right. Yeah, WTPRN's been cutting out tough all night. We did hear the last blurb of what your guest there was speaking before it broke away, just so you know. We did hear. But I did want to talk to you about some stuff that I talked about last week. I did want to ask this, what was his name? The gentleman running for office?
I'm sorry, Brian. I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you repeat the question?
Who did you have as a guest running for office?
We have a guest with us now. His name is Michael Mayo. Is that correct? He's running for the Pacific Green Party. He is a nominee, and so for the 3rd District of Oregon.
Okay. Now, what was he speaking to when he mentioned the UN treaty? Was he talking in acceptance of it, that he was pro-treaty, that he wanted?
Well, we only have one microphone, unfortunately, in studio, so I will go ahead and ask him that, because he's going to come back on in just a sec, so we'll continue the conversation. But I believe Ryan's asking about the UN treaty.
What were you talking about? UN treaty something?
The United Nations was formed in 1945 by the victorious Allied powers. Since 1945, every country in the entire world has joined the United Nations. It is the closest thing we have to a solution to the aggressive war that began, the aggressive wars that began World War II. In that chart, the signatories to the pact, beginning the United Nations, agreed solemnly. We have passed it through Congress. It has been ratified in every possible way to no longer use war or the threat of war as a weapon, as a means of their foreign policy. In fact, the Secretary General of the United Nations went on record as saying, when the United States invaded Iraq, that the United States at that time, in 2003, was violating the United Nations Charter.
And yeah, in a little bit, we can even go into some of the weapons they were using in 2003, some of the weird electromagnetic weapons and perhaps neutron weapons. I mean, it's all out there, and the Russians have them, too. Hey, Brian, did that answer your question, sir?
Well, it got me for what I was looking for. Thanks. He lost my vote, though. I do not support the corrupt organization of the United Nations. In my opinion, they are one of the issues that we face that is threatening our sovereign republic. But it's my opinion.
All right. Thank you for your call. Let's go back to some of the news headlines here and continue this dialogue because, you know, there's a lot happening in a short span of time. Michael, let's talk about the issue with Russia and Georgia and the United States. But I need to go over some news here to bring everyone up to date because every day things are changing and everybody needs to stay on top of it. There's a lot of stuff going on in the news. I actually should pause and say this. You know, we have 9/11 coming up tomorrow and, you know, a lot of people just, you know, yeah, we're still talking about it. It's always a part of the discussion. But now things are getting so weird. To the point where you can't just be focused on one issue. I mean, you're looking at 888 being the day that the U.S. via Georgia brought Russia their 9/11. And this is going to spill out all throughout that region, just like Brzezinski talked about in 1997, the Grand Chessboard. But here we see the U.S. negotiating with Georgia and Turkey to establish a naval base at one of the two key Georgian ports. Russia had previously announced its intention to station its own special forces at the Georgian ports. One of the responsibilities of U.S. Special Forces in the region is to ensure the security of an oil pipeline passing through Georgia. Interesting stuff.
The first thing we have to acknowledge is that there was a peaceful, although perhaps unstable, arrangement which was upset on August 8th by an invasion by Georgian forces. The first item is that that's a fact. That the Russians did not attack unprovokedly. They were responding to an attack by Georgia on what had been a breakaway region which had peacekeepers in it that was undergoing a moratorium on arms, and it was an attack by the Georgians. That first fact has to be acknowledged, and then we can go forward from there and say, should we try to assist the Russians? Should we try to hold back the Russians from what they have done to protect their interests in that region?
We also see that the U.S. has 761 military bases across the planet, according to Pentagon records. At the height of the Roman Empire, the Romans had an estimated 37 major military bases scattered around their regions that they controlled. At the height of the British Empire, they had 36 of them planet-wide. We see also from Yahoo News, the headline, Russia plans 7,600 troops. They plan to put 7,600 troops in Georgia to take on some rebels. This is more than twice the number based there before last month's war, and a level likely to alarm the West. The U.S. also is going to likely scrap a U.S.-Russian civilian nuclear cooperation pact next week in response to Moscow's actions in Georgia. And Russia said Monday that it will send a naval squadron and anti-submarine patrol planes to Venezuela. These carry nuclear and conventional warheads. This year for a joint military exercise in the Caribbean. A lot of people are making a lot of noise about this. A senior Venezuelan naval officer said four Russian ships would take part in the exercise, which would also involve Venezuelan aircraft and submarines. And Russia also scored an important diplomatic victory Friday when it secured support from six other former Soviet nations for its war in Georgia. So Hugo Chavez, a lot of people think he's a savior. He's a good guy because he's opposed Western imperialism. And he's got some interesting connections with Hu Jintao and Vladimir Putin and some other countries, including Cuba. And I'm not so sure he really is going to care about Americans in the very end. Regardless, this just seems to be another power play as he gets kind of pulled into the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, so he can have his interests met.
Venezuela was very close to a failed state when Hugo Chavez took over. I'm not exactly clear. I'd say it was about 8 years ago. When Chavez was elected president of Venezuela, there had been a breakdown. Both parties were so corrupt, nobody believed them anymore. There was an effort by Chavez to have taken over control by a coup d'etat. And so little prestige did the government against which he started his coup d'etat have that instead of being forever banished from political office, he was running for president at the next election. How does a democratic society renew itself when the old political parties are completely discredited? Actually, maybe we can learn from what Venezuela has done, because it is indeed responding to large majorities, and they are having free elections. Both of our national parties are somewhat discredited at the moment, and perhaps we will learn from the experience of the Venezuelans how to go from there.
Well, we have a break, and when we come back, we will talk to another gentleman that has a couple things to say. Michael, thanks for coming on, and we got another hour and a half here, and we'll probably go into some other areas as well. And for anyone that would like to make a statement, 512-646-1984, you're listening to We the People Radio Network.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
It's not left, it's not right, it's the state versus you. Alex Ansari, Outside the Box.
All right, in just a moment, we'll talk with Mike Hasty, who was at the RNC. He was attacked by police. He's a activist and Vietnam veteran. He's a part of Veterans for Peace. So we'll get his story and his take at the RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota, in just a couple minutes. I was talking about 2003 and electromagnetic super weapons, things of that nature, which may have been used in Iraq in 2003. It's alleged that Iraqi TV was taken out with one of these E-bombs. Well, here's a headline first from Pravda, which is a Russian publication. Headline reading, Russia creates electromagnetic super weapon. It's been revealed recently that Russian scientists developed a generator, the capacity of which is comparable to that of a nuclear unit. Missile troops and defense departments on the whole will most likely be the first customers to order the appliance. It is impossible to take photographs or film a video of the new generator in action when it's on because it immediately puts all electronic devices out of order. The research that was used for the creation of such a device can be applied in the development of electromagnetic weapons. One of the Russian scientists working on the project said, although it affects electrical devices, no one has ever studied biological effects of such impulses. Now, that's a statement I find hard to swallow, hard to believe. I think they've done exactly such a thing. Now, CNN even, U.S. media, they've recently reported on the electromagnetic weapons and other secret killing weapons being used in Iraq by the U.S. military. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Woodward, in his discussion with Larry King, he talked about the secret weapon that is wiping out alleged terrorists in large numbers and suggests that it may be a far more barbaric device than a simple EMP weapon. One possibility is that the weapon is something similar to that described to filmmaker Patrick Dillon by Iraqi infantryman Majid al-Ghazari, a frightening giant flamethrower-type device that instead shoots out concentrated lightning bolts or radiation bursts that result in vehicles and people being almost literally liquefied. There are many eyewitness accounts in 2003 describing buses full of people vaporized by some kind of weapon burning people alive. This is pretty intense stuff, but that was 5 years ago. I mean, I wonder what they have now. And we're seeing reports about local law enforcement getting different types of EMP weapons. It's a scary view of the future. Now, we're going to pause on that before we get to some of the other headlines, including Iran's announcement for war games, Iran-China boosting ties, Pakistan threatening to retaliate against the U.S., and a school shooting drill that terrified unknowing teachers, just like how we have the MH6s over Portland, psychological warfare, creation of fear. Here we have an elementary school with a gunman bursting in, and this is kind of alarming. But before we get to that, we'll talk with Mike Hasty. He was at the RNC. That was quite an event there, the RNC. I mean, you had the whole police state out in action at the DNC, but it seemed like once the RNC came along, they got some sort of an injection of steroids, snatching Amy Goodman and attacking her reporters.
Yeah, I would have to say that during the time that I was there, which was actually about 10 days, I covered the Veterans for Peace National Convention and also was photographing Iraq Veterans Against the War Convention that was there. And then I was in the streets covering the demonstrations that occurred there in Minneapolis-St. Paul from September the 1st through the 4th. And I would have to say that I've never seen so many cops in my life at one place. What I was seeing basically is that the police were provoking, and they were looking for incidents to attack protesters. And I felt like for the most part the protesters were not antagonizing the police. Everything was a show of force. Everything was fear related. I was at an intersection in St. Paul where the Mickey's Diner car restaurant is there. It's a pretty famous restaurant there. And what happened with me is I'm a Vietnam veteran, and there was police that was kind of an L shape. They were lined up kind of in an L shape there on the intersection there. And so I went up and down the police and told them why I was there. I told them I was a Vietnam veteran, that I served my country in Vietnam. I was a recipient of a Bronze Star, and that I was there to just talk about why I was against what I saw the Republican Party's politics and their stand in Iraq. and that I was I had was I talked about how McCain continues to support this war. He's sending military troops over there for their second, third, fourth tour, and these guys are coming back, and they're not going to survive. I've dealt with suicide before. I've lost friends that committed suicide in Vietnam as a result of that committed suicide in Vietnam, and also when they came back, they committed suicide as a result of being in Vietnam.
Oh, I wanted to add something to that because I have an interesting report right here. 16 U.S. troops commit suicide in Iraq at one time. The troops' motivations for suicide are not known at this time, but according to Iraqi sources, the servicemen belonged to a unit of the U.S. Airborne Division that was behind the massacre of several Iraqi families, mostly women and children, in northern Baghdad, according to an Iraqi security official. He added that they used potent narcotics to kill themselves. And a witness said the bodies of the U.S. troops became misshapen in such a way that they look like 5,000-year-old mummies. That's kind of a weird story. But it also makes you wonder what's going on over there in Iraq. I mean, you're also hearing about soldiers being electrocuted on a regular basis through the conditions that they're living in, these little great facilities that KBR is building for them. So it's really tragic, but it's really sad to see how they are breaking servicemen and their spirits when they come back.
This is exactly the same thing I was experiencing in Vietnam. I was in Vietnam toward the latter stages of the Vietnam War, when I was seeing all of the rapid disintegration of American involvement in American units. I was there from September of 1970 to September of 1971. So I was seeing the homicides, the suicides, the shootouts, the racial tension. I was seeing the rampant heroin addiction. And it's just everything was crumbling around us. We were getting casualties in from the field, and we would occasionally get hit. But so much of what was going on was happening inside our own boundaries. I mean, I hadn't been in my unit but maybe a month, and an American enlisted man walked up to a captain who was a captain of one of our troops and shot him with an M16. You know, I saw this more than once. I saw a shootout between two soldiers. One of them was shot in the stomach and was killed. I remember going into Graves registration one time where a soldier, a heroin addict, had taken a pistol, shot himself in the head. On another occasion, I went into a tent one time, was awakened about 2 o'clock in the morning by a medic who was in charge of quarters, and he told me that somebody had shot themselves over in Charlie Troop. He himself was loaded on heroin. And I was in my hooch with a really good friend, so he and I went jumped in a litter jeep, went over to Charlie Troop, and when I went into the tent, the soldier who was evidently getting ready to go back to the United States, who was addicted to heroin, took an M16, put it to his head, and blew his brains out, and I had blood all over my hands and brains on my lap. So these are the kind of things that were happening. And these are the kind of things that we're going to be seeing in Iraq. One of the biggest things that separates what I see happening, that happened in Vietnam versus what is happening in Iraq is the multiple deployments. The multiple deployments are going to cause massive suicides against with these Iraq vets and Afghanistan vets. If I'd had to serve another tour in Vietnam, I probably wouldn't be talking right now, because this war is a total lie, and the troops on the ground are realizing it. Just like, you know, after I'd been in Vietnam for a few months, I finally realized that there was no reason for us to be in Vietnam, that I was a pawn in a chess game, and that the entire Vietnam War was a lie. And even if you take, let's take a look at Robert McNamara's statistics from Vietnam, which are conservative. He was saying that we were killing 1,000 innocent Vietnamese people a week. Okay, that's 4,000 a month. That's 48,000 a year. Let's say the war lasted 8 years. That's almost 400,000 innocent Vietnamese people that were killed by our government, because we were essentially bombing everything in Vietnam. We were dropping napalm on everything in Vietnam. We were firing artillery at everything in Vietnam. We sprayed Agent Orange on approximately 1/7 the land mass area in what was then South Vietnam.
We got a break coming up, and we're going to continue this conversation as well, and we'll also go back to the RNC and see what else you saw there. So I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and it's highly alarming, because the challenges that we face today are far larger than the challenges faced after Vietnam, I feel. The debt is much higher. And so people do need to come together in a big, big, big way. The way that we haven't for a long, long, long time. Stay with us. Focus is also on Pakistan, not just Iran, in terms of what's going on today. Musharraf has stepped down, and now we're seeing the country threatening to retaliate against the U.S. In recent months, there's been an increase in missile strikes on what the U.S. claims are militants in Pakistan's tribal areas. U.S. strikes on Pakistani territory have killed scores of civilians this year and have sparked national outrage. A spokesman for the Pakistani army says, "We have informed them, being the U.S., that we reserve the right to self-defense and that we will retaliate if the U.S. continues cross-border attacks." Now, to pause and go back to Mike Hasty, part of Veterans for Peace, Vietnam vet, seen a lot of things in his life, attacked recently at the RNC, saw a lot of the action. Things are getting really intense in terms of dehumanizing, deconstructing what I see as the U.S. military, because I look at this whole war, and I never thought we were in it to necessarily win every aspect of it, but to a certain degree fund it constantly through these different agencies and security companies they set up and mercenary corporations and whatnot. Just another way to get a whole lot of money out of the country off the sweat, off the backs of the mercenaries and the men in the armed forces to go out and occupy. They may not win, but they'll still be charging the taxpayers a certain amount of money. I don't see how, I'm very confused by how they've gone about the Iraq war and how they've treated some of the servicemen and how they've, you know, what is your take on some of that? Have you ever been suspicious about their intentions and whether they thought they can really win this thing or Vietnam for that matter?
I think the main thing is that the American people have forgotten their history. They have no idea what they're getting into. They thought they could go in there and set up the same scenario that was that initially happened in Vietnam when we injected a horrendous bolus of money into that country, supported the South Vietnamese government, which was essentially a make believe government that we put in power. And I think if the United States figured they could, if they just put enough power into that country, that you know, they could bring the Vietnamese people to their knees. But you know, there's something that I wrote on the back of a card that I give out. It's a picture of a Y helicopter that was in my unit. It was just simply a medevac helicopter that had the word Y painted on the front, because the crew evidently decided to do that, because toward the end of the war, we were all asking ourselves, basically, why are we in this country? And there's a statement that I write, that I wrote on the front of the card, which is simply, lying is the most powerful weapon in war. And let me read this to you. It's on the back of the card, and basically I wrote here, I said, "You do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the peace table by killing innocent civilians. They are military targets. The primary goal of the aggressor nation is to break the spirit of the people and its ability to defend its homeland. This strategy is as old as warfare itself." And I think that has been true for ever since man's been going to war with each other. And I think, you know, I remember one time I was in a bunker and a sniper round went over my head. And I years later, I finally realized that the person who tried to kill me was not a militant, was not a terrorist, was not a so-called insurgent. That the Vietnamese individual who tried to kill me was nothing more than a citizen that did not want me in his country. And, you know, and it's amazing how millions of people are not aware of this truth. You know, I was the enemy in Vietnam. You know, I was the aggressor. And the exact same thing is what we're seeing in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we are the aggressor nation. You know, we are over there to this is a war of resources, and we're over there to steal resources and utilize their indigenous people as a cheap labor force. I mean that's the name of the game. You know, America has become a parasitic economy, and we're like a swarming locust going around the world, you know, taking out people, anybody who can't defend themselves.
Did you want to go over real quick, and then I'm going to go back to the news, some of the stuff that you saw at the RNC? You've never seen that many police in a protest prior to that?
Yeah, I think I was just overwhelmed by the number of police that were there. I mean, they came from all over the country. And there was one incident where I was, like I say, I was at that intersection where the Mickey's dining car is located in St. Paul. And, you know, the protesters were essentially where, you know, where the event was really kind of coming to a close. And so the people that were working with the police that were, that were with the protesters acting as a peace coalition, were, you know, actually getting people to march north and getting them away from the main events that were going on there, because the police were getting ready to attack us. And so what happened is that as more and more the protesters started to go north, and you could tell the energy of the march was kind of calming down, and all of a sudden the smoke went off, concussion grenades went off, and then the police launched tear gas, and then they started running at us. And then I turned around, and I had two cameras, and I was taking photographs as fast as I could. And I went into what was called a U-Bank. It's just a bank that's got windows around it, and you go in and check cash checks and things with tellers behind bulletproof windows. And so I ran in there real quick, and I went in the corner, and I hid behind an ATM machine because I was frantically trying to get my memory cards out of my camera so the cops wouldn't take them or delete the memory cards. And so the cops came in yelling and screaming and telling everybody to get out. And so one cop made a final sweep, and he noticed me in the corner, so he went over to me, threw me down to the ground, and then about maybe less than 15-20 seconds later, about three or four other cops came in riot gear, and they were screaming and hollering me to get up. So I grabbed my memory cards, which were on the floor, which I'm surprised they even let me have. And so they grabbed me behind the neck and probably the belt, and they ran me out of that area. And then they ran me down about a half a block as fast as they could run me. And then they ran me to where the police line was, and the police opened up a little window there, and they just shoved me through that the barricade that the police had established there. So I'm amazed that I didn't get arrested or didn't get wailed on by their batons. But for some reason, I think they cut me some slack, because it was just maybe 15-20 minutes earlier than that I had lectured the police. And I really didn't lecture in a way of in disrespect. I was basically just telling them why I was there. And I think some of them maybe took some sympathy that I was a Vietnam veteran and decided not to make it worse. So I feel fortunate that they didn't hit me with a baton. So
it really tells you a little bit about someone's character when they're real quick to hit women. Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of stories like that coming out of the DNC and RNC, and a whole lot of videotapes. You'll see a code pink female protester, very weak compared to one of these rag cop guys all up in garb, baton straight to the head. Ooh, there's a real man. I mean, this is insane. It's like what we're really seeing here is this opportunity for people that are thugs to get in the uniform and hurt people so they can feel a sense of power. And right now we're seeing a police state emerge. Even if people aren't being told to abuse people, they do it anyway because they know they live in a climate where there is no accountability. Like there may have been in the past in some areas. Things have been worse in the past. There's a lot of horror stories of the South. Some of those type of characters and mentalities are still around, but they're not just in the South. They're in the White House. They're in Congress, unfortunately. So that's a really, really interesting story. You ran into, I'm going to go back here, the store, and they followed you in there. Is it, so they were watching you. They were chasing you. They were having fun doing this.
Yeah, it was interesting that when I was going up and down the police, giving my lecture, that there was an army medic there that happened to have a video camera, a small little video camera, and so he photographed it, and he was in the army during the occupation of Grenada, and so he put it on YouTube, and it's simply, I think it's titled Vietnam Medic Tells Off the Cops at the RNC. So if you go to YouTube, you'll see that video. And also, I was interviewed on Democracy Now. Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book Blackwater, interviewed me, and basically, I just told him what I felt of John McCain, because I know what John McCain did in the war. He had 23 bombing missions, primarily over Hanoi, and I know what they were bombing in Hanoi. They were bombing civilian targets, and. So I remember a couple other incidences where the police would grab people that were on the line close to the police, when they had rights, they would just run across the line and grab people. Another occasion, I saw an individual get pepper sprayed and arrested. I took a picture of that. And another interesting incident happened when I was on Thursday, when there was the last major protest where people sat down on a bridge. And there was a woman that was running across the parking lot there in the Sears parking lot, right, which was right near the place where it happened. And there was about six or seven percussion grenades that went off. And as I was running across the parking lot, there was police that were chasing a woman, a protester, and they were chasing her down like she was a fox. And so what they did is a police officer rammed her with her bike.
That's an amazing story. We're going to break in 5 seconds. Stick around. Get the rest of it.